This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. What does the DOJ want out of Apple? The agency's lawsuit against the company on antitrust grounds is a direct attack on Apple's walled garden approach to iPhone apps, claiming the company is effectively a monopoly in some markets. Cato's Jennifer Huddleston and Patrick Hedger of the Taxpayer Protection Alliance discuss the elements of the case. Jen, I want to start with you. Was this suit expected?
It was and it wasn't. We know that the DOJ has been investigating Apple for some time. It kind of seemed almost inevitable, given that we've already seen antitrust cases brought against three of the four leading tech companies that have been under investigation. But I do think the exact nature of this suit was a little bit surprising for a couple of reasons. First, we've already seen the case in Epic v. Apple be found in Apple's favor. That was largely dealing with the question of app stores and potentially fees in app stores and payment processors and many of the questions that have been brought up around the app store itself. And so the DOJ's case instead is focusing on these other demands that are not exactly what one would expect. There's been a lot of attention paid, for example, to the fact that it is very concerned about the social stigma of when somebody has a green bubble in a group chat.
Pat, when we start thinking about the different models that hardware and software producers engage in to try to eat somebody else's lunch in some marketplace, you know, Walt Mossberg, formerly the Wall Street Journal, pointed out some of the key elements that the DOJ is complaining about with respect to the iPhone specifically. This has been a key differentiating element of Apple since almost day one.
Yeah, that's the big problem with this case. And a lot of the other antitrust cases, they tend to be blind to competition up and downstream from the core product or service in question. And in a lot of cases, you see the DOJ and FTC ignoring how much Google or Amazon have enhanced competition in the retail space, enhanced competition in the advertising space. And in this case, you see the DOJ looking upstream and in a sense, trying to enhance competition at the device level, at the third-party device level. We're talking like smartwatches and things like that, various apps, increased sideloading. But what they don't consider is competition between the two main device providers, device operating system providers. And what the judge found in the civil case where Epic sued Apple, trying to break open Apple's ecosystem that you're talking about, is that it is a fundamental competitive difference of Apple that it has this walled garden. And that's a choice. And Android has a more open ecosystem. Apple's choice is a key competitive differentiating factor. And it seems weird in an area where you effectively do have a duopoly between Android operating systems and iOS operating systems to eliminate that single choice at the most important entry point of the marketplace, which is which device people are going to buy, an iPhone versus an Android. So in trying to enhance competition downstream at the smartwatch level and the app level, they're eliminating the most competitive aspect of the iPhone, which is its unique operating system.
And it makes a lot of presumption about why people are making that choice, that there are only certain factors that play into it. When if you think about it, which smartphone you choose is a more complicated choice and has a lot of factors that may vary from person to person. So some individuals may really like the Apple product because they know it's a closed ecosystem. They feel that it's more secure. They want that kind of out-of-the-box, fresh, only what's been approved to be put on it can be put on it approach, whether it's for themselves or for an elderly relative or a young person who's getting their first device. Other people really care about things like camera quality or may really care about the ability to do whatever they want with their phone, to put on any apps, to get them from sideloading or anywhere else, and care less about those security features. Some may care about things like sound quality on a phone or picture quality on playback. It can vary so much from person to person. And this is making a lot of presumptions about why people are making the choices that they are.
Yeah, and it gets to the big problem with this case is that the people that are most concerned with Apple's operating system and it being a closed ecosystem are people that are offering competing products. And that's not what antitrust law is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about preserving competition, not protecting specific competitors. And we see a lot of that, whether it's the regulatory action in the European Union, the civil cases, civil antitrust cases that have been filed, or the cases that are being taken up by DOJ and FTC. A lot of them are rooted in complaints of competitors in the space. Billion-dollar companies going after trillion-dollar companies. And that's why I think the popular reaction to this case, you look at a lot of the comments on social media, folks saying, well, why? I like my iPhone.
So how seriously should we take the complaints about market share? That is, in the United States, I believe the iPhone has about 50%. Globally, it's only about 25%. When we talk about monopoly, a 50% market share could mean a pretty significant ability to somewhat adjust or move prices in the direction that the firm wants.
And this is why we had the reforms that we did in the 1970s with Robert Bork and the Consumer Welfare Standard and the Chicago School, because we didn't want to have a set of laws that punish success. The Apple got to this point because they built a product that works really well. And part of the product working really well for a long time is the closed ecosystem that everybody's complaining about. It's very hard to get malware on your device. It's very hard to brick your iPhone. And so we wanted an antitrust case law that didn't punish somebody for producing a really great product that had widespread adoption, which is fundamentally the case here, in my view.
The underlying question should be not how popular a company is, but why are they popular when we're looking at concentration? If a company is successful because they're making a product that consumers like, or because they were the first ones to do something, then of course, initially, they're going to have a larger market share. I would point out that 50% still sounds really competitive to me. It sounds like there's a lot of options out there on the market. But even if you want to say it's a slight majority, there's still a lot of choice there and a lot of reasons that they could have achieved that through perfectly competitive means. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier when it comes to who should the focus of antitrust law be on. Traditionally, what we've seen is that the focus is on consumers and consumer welfare, not on competitors, not on some kind of arbitrary metrics that the government gets to dictate about how many players should be in a market or who should have what percentage of a market or things like that. It's up to consumers to decide what products should succeed and fail.
And even the DOJ in this case, I think they concede that Apple's 50% market share in the smartphone market in the United States wasn't sufficient for arguing this case, because they actually define the market in the complaint as the luxury smartphone market. Now, it's kind of interesting to define something that 50% of the market has as a luxury, but that also makes an interesting concession that I'm surprised the DOJ is willing to make, which concedes that it's a better product. It's a higher quality product in certain respects. I mean, there are great aspects of Android's ecosystem, but those are individual consumer choices about what is better for who.
One point that, Patrick, I think you've made at least recently, and I think that it's really relevant to a lot of other efforts that the federal government is undertaking, and that is the notion that Apple has a walled garden, as the term of art used to describe its app store, which means they reject a lot of apps. They demand certain information from app makers about what kinds of information are being collected and for what purposes. And of course, you're developing on a whole different platform. Apple then takes a pretty sizable cut of the app revenues that you might otherwise collect, but that is all done in service to protecting consumers from malicious software that might otherwise be placed on their phones. And as you note, importantly, if you want to control what apps go on your kid's phone, breaking up that walled garden would make that quite a bit harder.
Yeah, it's interesting. Right now, the big tech story besides this in Washington is this bill to ban TikTok. And regardless of what you think about that bill, the mechanism it does that through is trying to ban it on app stores. And it seems very interesting that on one hand, the federal government, including the Biden administration, endorses that approach where we're going to use the Apple App Store in particular to try and control the distribution of TikTok. But we're also going to blow open the closed ecosystem of Apple, which would just allow anybody to download that app if they wanted to. I see this broadly across tech policy, is that there's just a large effort to throw everything against the wall and see what sticks and see who you can beat up and make a name for yourself. And I think that's a really problematic approach to tech.
And to echo what Pat was saying about how these interact, we've seen this also come up, you know, in terms of kids' online safety. Of a lot of these are features that parents want for parental controls, the ability to be notified if their young person is running up a significant bill on Angry Birds or whatever game is popular these days. And some of those parental control features might not be available if we were to see certain remedies. The complaint is very vague in the sense of it doesn't propose certain remedies of what the government even thinks could fix this situation as it attempts to identify. You know, you asked earlier, Caleb, was this expected or not? I would say just because it, you know, at times seems like they've been under investigation by the DOJ for several years now, given other big tech cases, it seemed likely that you might see a case filed. That doesn't mean it's good. That doesn't mean that it's objective. If anything, it kind of goes to the concerning trend in general that we've seen not only at the FTC, but also in DOJ antitrust, to really bring about this neo-Brandeisian antitrust movement that focuses, again, on those pre-Bork standards of antitrust, is really looking at the presumption that big is bad, focusing on competitors, not consumers, and really moving away from that objective economic analysis.
Before we get to the silly, I mean, just outright silly elements of this suit, what might this open up if DOJ is successful here? What are the follow-on effects that we might see for other firms?
I worry that what you're seeing here is, to Jennifer's point, and broadly in antitrust, is a way to try to micromanage markets through M&A enforcement. And the underlying antitrust statutes themselves, the Sherman and the Clayton Act, are pretty vague. And we're really dependent on case law and precedent to guide what the government can and cannot do. And what we're seeing is, and this is included as a way to try and poke and prod at that as much as possible and establish new precedents that kind of get back to the antitrust standards that existed prior to consumer welfare, in which a Supreme Court justice remarked in an antitrust case in the 20th century and said, the only consistency I can find in any of these cases is that the government always wins. I fear that that's what we're headed back to, is that if a business gets too big or too powerful politically or economically for whatever reason, the government is fashioning itself a tool to knock it down. And I think that's really concerning. And it's a way to force companies to do things that you couldn't otherwise get through Congress in terms of a piece of legislation. We're going to have M&A enforcement that asks, how many union jobs do you have? What kind of other DEI or quote unquote woke things, if it's a Democratic administration, are you going to be able to implement if we allow your companies to merge? And we'll see the shoe on the other foot on the right as populists look to increasingly weaponize government for their own ends. So that's what I think is really concerning, is the unmooring of antitrust from objective standards of consumer harm.
We see a lot of focus on antitrust, on the impact that it has on companies. And that's certainly part of the conversation, the way this will impact business decisions. But I think we have to remember what the downstream effect of those business decisions are, which is ultimately, what does this mean for the American consumer, for the average American? Because the concerning thing is, we may lose out on what would be beneficial advances, beneficial innovations in terms of how a innovator, a large company, might want to incorporate some technology from a smaller company that they acquired, how they may want to naturally evolve their product, but they feel that they can't because they're subject to these particular restrictions. We've seen this to some degree with how competition has played out in Europe. Recently, the Digital Markets Act went into effect, and there was a lot of frustration with what it meant to people with their smartphones and having to go in and select certain things that they weren't used to having to select. And some people may brush that off as, well, it took you a couple of extra clicks, and who hasn't had that moment where they've gotten frustrated with their phone about something? But at the end of the day, the question is, should policymakers be product designers or should entrepreneurs be product designers? And what we're potentially going to see is not only in the tech marketplace, but given the impact that this broader approach to antitrust could have, a much higher likelihood that we're going to see more involvement of policymakers and product designers than the market and entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and you open the doors to a lot of rent seeking with a case like this, because it says that, you know, I want this business to carry my product, and if they don't, it's inherently anti-competitive, and that's just not the case. If you look at other businesses, I think it's important that we compare what we see in tech to other businesses, because the law should apply as equally as possible. And I think it's really unfortunate that we see in the tech marketplace something that we would never expect if we were looking at a department store, right? Something like a luxury department store like Nordstrom's is not going to carry certain brands. They're going to cut deals with the types of brands and providers that they trust and that they can stand behind their product, both as the retailer and because they've got a relationship with the manufacturer. And I think you see a little bit of that in Apple, right? They don't want to put anything in their app store that may harm the end user. And they want to be able to stand behind purchases that you make in app. And I think that's pro-consumer to have multiple layers of accountability in a transaction. If something's wrong with my whatever app that I've got to purchase with, Apple can stand behind it. And I can also go to the app developer as well in an ecosystem where, you know, the system is more open and Apple's or Android or whoever is taken out of the picture, that creates inherent more opportunities for scams and malware and things like that. And you see it, right? The Android offers benefits. There are trade-offs, right? The old Thomas Sowell quote, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. There are good things about the Android ecosystem in it being more open, but the security trade-off is there. The Nokia reports every year show that the vast majority of malware in the smartphone ecosystem occurs on Androids.
And now the part that I consider to be silly, but the DOJ presents very seriously, and that is the notion of the different color of text bubbles that you see on your phone when you are communicating with someone with a different kind of phone. I understand, of course, that there is functionality that Apple builds into their devices to work with other Apple devices, but that's not new at all.
Yeah, it's such a reach. I mean, it's really, you're taking a meme and applying it into federal court in a criminal DOJ antitrust complaint. I mean, like, that is such a leap. One great example, though, of them not thinking about the true competitive dynamics of these decisions is, yes, there are some frictions communicating between iMessage and somebody that doesn't have iMessage, but that also incentivizes folks to go out and find options that work for them. Just on my own team, we have a person that has an Android. So we decided to get a WhatsApp chat for the office. And that's a competitive app that I was able to download onto my iPhone. And it has a competing company, Meta. So yes, Apple's decision there didn't work for our office, but we were able to use a competing system. And I just, where's the fire?
Yeah, to echo Patrick, I think it misrepresents how many different options the average user is choosing. And that, again, much like choosing the smartphone itself, there are a lot of different reasons why you may choose to have a group chat on iMessage versus WhatsApp versus Signal versus
Slack
versus any number of apps that are out there. Most of us aren't just using one messaging service to communicate with each other. We're using a wide array of different messaging services, you know, to stay in touch with even different friends and family. And even within the technology itself, the idea that the green bubble is letting you know that this is a different type of message so that if you don't get certain features available or when you send certain photos or whatever, that it may operate differently is actually, you know, having that bubble be green instead of blue can signal valuable information that's not social stigmatizing, I think is the term that they use, but allowing users to know how things are interacting with their phone so that then they can decide, hey, maybe we do want to take this to WhatsApp instead of iMessage.
Patrick Hedger directs the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. Jennifer Huddleston is a research fellow at the Cato Institute. Free Society is a new quarterly magazine from Cato. The inaugural issue features the stories of two tenacious families in their fight for educational freedom, among other stories. That's all at cato.org/freesociety. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please. And thank you for listening.